We're ready to bring on our keynote speaker for the evening now. I'm really pleased to introduce our next speaker. He's coming to us all the way from Berkeley, California, where he serves as professor of integrative biology, as well as the curator of the Museum of Paleontology in Berkeley. He's been at the forefront of something that's very important to me, and I expect many of you in the audience, and that is the promotion of science education and quality science education in this country. He's worked both as a public school teacher, also to develop California's state science education framework, and additionally served as the president of the National Center for Science Education for 16 years. We're happy to have him in town today to discuss something that was a pretty pivotal moment in the history of science education, and that was his involvement in the 2005 widely publicized Kitzmühler versus Dover Board of Education trial. He's widely recognized for his expertise in the field of integrative biology and also the evolution of vertebrates. And so we're very happy to have him in town to share some of his insights from his expertise in that field as well as his experience in Dover in 2005. So without further introduction, I give you Dr. Kevin Padian.
What?
Oh. Thank you, Brian. Good morning. Good. Okay. Well, how we doing, Madison? It's nice to be here in Wisconsin. I've been here for 30 years. It's nice to be here in Wisconsin where the trees are just about the right height. All right, I want to burn through a bunch of this stuff because you probably have things you want to say. Everybody has different backgrounds. Let me just talk to you a little bit about Darwin. I give talks sometime about Darwin where I talk about how important it is to understand what words meant in his time, which you can't understand if you don't read what he read. And the reason why he doesn't use the term evolution in The Origin of Species is that it meant something different. It meant that there was a preordained plan. It didn't have to be religious, but it was like a fiddlehead fern opening up, like a snail shell uncoiling, stuff like that. He used the word occasionally, transmutation, which was change from one kind to another, but people didn't use that much in the Victorian era because they didn't have any evidence for it. They didn't know much about it. Darwin's own definition of evolution is descent with modification. It's still, I think, the best one because it encompasses everything and it doesn't leave out anything important. But there's another definition of evolution that is actually came from scientists, but creationists of various stripes love it. And it's called random variation and natural selection. That's what the general creationist definition of evolution is, random variation and natural selection. That's kind of like saying that a house is the plumbing in the front door. So there's lots of other things going on here. That's why descent with modification, although it's shorter and simpler, really encompasses a lot more. This is the word that scares the hell out of many people. Now, if I ask you what random means, I know what the students are going to say. Because they say, I mean, like, that's just so random. Everybody my age gets that a lot. Oh, like, you're still random. Okay, all right. So, random is fine. Like, it's fine to use words as common people do it. It's fine to use words as scientific nerds use them. That's fine, too. But as long as we know what we're talking about, the internet is a wonderful place. And some years ago, I found this statistic. It's really cool. Fires per year in Riverside, California, okay? The incidence is about 0.05%. So the probability that your Riverside house will burn, all things considered, is that, okay? If the causes of fire are random. But we know that the causes of fire are not random. There are three main causes of fire. smoking in bed, kicking over the lava lamp when you're stoned, and ex-wife gets the house, ex-husband comes back and torches it. So randomness is really not about cause in science. It's about outcomes. And it's not just like a random outcome. It's a distribution of possible outcomes. And I said possible outcomes deliberately because most of what we know in science, if we study a phenomenon at all, we have some idea of what is possible as outcomes. We can have some exceptions, but here are some interesting things about that. We know that a duck's head is not going to pop up on a trout. So that's not the kind of randomness we're talking about. In a range of possible outcomes, we study things enough, or we understand the mechanism enough, to get a sense of probability, don't we? We can look at birth defects. We can look at distribution of various traits in population. We can look at everything. But we can't say. I mean, we know about the risk for many kinds of genetic disorders in humans, but we cannot say in advance which individuals will have that when they're born. We can talk about risk factors. And that is confirmation to randomness, oddly enough. So it's a good thing about separating cause and outcome. Very little in evolution has any randomness at all in its cause. There's genetic drift, but that's really, again, that's mostly its outcome, and we don't know what the cause is. But really, everything. Oh, and like, you know, what's the main principle of evolution that Darwin wrote that whole big book about? What's that called? Or did somebody say pigeons? The origin of species by means of natural selection. Good. Now let me ask the students here. Did you get into University of Wisconsin at random or were you selected? It's hard to tell. But that's also true for the faculty. So random and selection are completely different things, right? So that definition is really kind of weird. And to me, evolution is not unguided like that. This Cardinal Schönbrunn's. I think that selection is a guiding force, or the struggle for existence, as Darwin more correctly put it. I mean, selection is kind of the end, the aftermath of what happens after the struggle of existence is all over and the battlefield is cleared. Okay. And evolution doesn't mean that anything can happen. There aren't any rules. There are rules in evolution. There are things we understand about evolutionary processes, and most of them are not random. Now, I want you to understand that Darwin is not an atheist in any sense of the word at any point in his life. He changes his views as he goes through life like most people. He changes his views utterly when his daughter dies at 10 years old, horribly. He gives up his faith in divine providence. But he doesn't have much to give up, because he's not the kind of theist. He's not a fundamentalist. He's not a church-going believer in a guy that walks around in the garden with bare feet and a flowing white beard, okay, and gets mad at Moses. That's not his conception of God. It's also not Jefferson's or Adams or Washington's or any of those people. Tom Paine is an atheist. Okay, the other founding fathers are men of the Enlightenment, not women of the Enlightenment. They are educated differently. They tend to be more conservative religiously, which is why Emma argues with her husband, Charles, about the whole thing of evolution. She has more of a problem. That's a separation issue. This is what Darwin says about this. So if you agree with him, you're Darwinian, because that's what he thought. He's not an atheist. He's not an agnostic until later in his life, maybe. Huxley invents the term. Darwin doesn't. This you can regard as typical Victorian purple prose, but you should read it straight. Darwin is a meliorist. He thinks things will get better. He sees no moral struggle in nature. He doesn't think the lions are bad. He just thinks they're doing their job. And although his whole idea about biology revolves around the struggle for existence, he doesn't see that in any way ethical or religious. That's just what happens. There are lots of scales of looking at how things go. You can have a monolithic definition of an atheist. I don't. I tend to follow Michel Onfray, who writes in the Atheist Manifesto that there are really several kinds of atheists. For the Greeks, an atheist was anybody who didn't believe what they believe. They could have other kinds of gods, but they're still atheists because they were without their god. So atheist means without God. Okay, so that would be an anti-theist, and there are people who declare openly God does not exist. That's a stupid idea, and anyone who thinks about it is nuts. We know people like that. You may be a person like that. That's fine. But that's an anti-theist, to put a sort of more point on it. A non-theist simply exists without the idea of God. The question is not interesting. I live my life without it. I do not care. An allotheist, allo meaning different, I would regard as someone who believes in different gods than you do, but you don't necessarily think he's a believer because he doesn't believe what you believe. So fundamentalist Christians do not think Catholics are Christians. A great many of them don't. Historically, that's a little weird. But, you know, in terms of beliefs, that's what they think. They have a different concept of God. Now, that may or may not make sense to you, but, you know, people believe all kinds of shit, so I don't care about that. But those are several kinds of things that we could call atheists. We don't have to have a monolithic concept of this. An agnostic is someone who doesn't know, but the question is still engaging. Okay? And deists are people who, like Darwin, think there's something out there, but they don't really personify it. They don't put sandals on it and have it walk in the garden. And we sometimes talk about theistic, because theists are people who do think that there is a presence, like some being that is a god who does certain things and acts in some way or another. And theistic evolution tends to be the belief that God starts evolution, but then doesn't mess around with it, just sort of starts the patterns and processes, the laws of nature, all this, and lets them roll, pretty much. Does not interfere to make miracles, but just sort of guides things. And I know that many scientists who work completely in a scientific paradigm are just absolutely fine with everything evolution, but they do think that God guides the beat of every sparrow's wing, even though he doesn't control the aerodynamics. Right? He set those up a long time ago. So this is a whole spectrum of how we think, and then there are fundamentalists, and we know about them. And then, you know, so the deist view is one that is pretty much an enlightenment in light. I can say that easy for me. The Enlightenment viewpoint, for most people who were writing the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the French Revolution, these are deists for the most part. We know about polls in our country. They're always really strange. Gallup's taken these for a long time. You know about these choices. This like tells you how screwed up polls are, because it depends on how you phrase the question and how you ask it. So there are going to be differences there. And I don't want you to think that the 44, the ones who think that God created humans in their present form, these are not the people necessarily who think the Flintstones is a documentary. Because if you read this question, it is perfectly sane to take the answer for this as meaning evolution is fine, but at some point God takes this primate, this Australopithecine, whatever it happens to be, ape, and breathes a soul into it. And maybe it's about 10,000 years ago. I mean, who knows? I mean, geologic time, I don't know. They're just numbers. Okay, so that would not be necessarily, I think this is a really tough poll to answer because the choices are weird. But a different poll conducted by a very different organization asked a very simple question. Survey says, now, that's a little different. Some of us have a problem. What does that mean? It turns out that the same poll asked some other questions and got correlations with some of these things. They are correlations because the same people answered the same questions in the same way, and those are the people who did it. So this is all fine, but it tells us that we have a certain percentage of citizens in our country who have this worldview. And they're certainly entitled to it. And I think as Eliot said, you know, it's a choice. How are you going to say it? By the way, I should say this, Eliot, this is solid gold. There are very few philosophers of science that get down in the trenches with those people like us who do this. And he is the best there is. So you are really lucky to have him here. I want to say that. Now, about 15 years ago, this became a big question on the American scene. Intelligent design seemed to come from nowhere. Op-ed pieces written that said, well, you know, there's this other really reasonable idea that, and it's an alternative to evolution, that actually, you know, a lot of science is okay, but sometimes there's some things that are really complex, and we can't explain those. Science doesn't have a real answer for those. So that's maybe where we could say that there's some kind of intelligent design in the universe, okay? After all, we're Americans. That's fair. It's balanced. Okay, this guy is a national treasure. But it's not fair. That's not what intelligent design is saying. Okay, that's optimality. Biologists are more guilty of this than intelligent design advocates, because we have so much optimality thinking in evolution that has no reason. It's a whole cult that's existed for 50 years, and it's wrong. So don't hang this on the ID, folks. I want to start out first to say the ID is not the same as the... They're not saying that God makes all the rules and then sits back and lets them run. He's saying, no, God did that. And most of the time that works okay, but sometimes there's something that's too complex to work by those processes. So then that intelligent designer has to come in and fix that, has to suspend those laws and do something different. In education, we call that a science stopper. We can't study miracles. That intelligent design view of the modern-day intelligent design folks at the Discovery Institute in Seattle is not exactly William Paley's intelligent design of the late 1700s that Darwin read at Cambridge, and they were still reading at Cambridge 100 years later. The idea was not original to Paley. It was around for at least 100 years before that. But Paley starts his book saying, watch, you know, if you were walking along a heath, because there were heaths where he came from, and if you kind of stubbed your foot against a stone, you wouldn't think anything of it. You thought, oh, it's been there forever. But if you did the same to a watch, you wouldn't draw that conclusion, because you'd pick it up and you go, this is a really complex thing. You know, it has a function. It has lots of moving parts. They all fit together really well. If you took out one of these parts, it wouldn't work anymore. So Paley's argument, as you know, is this watch is so complex, there must be a watchmaker. And the intricate interrelationships of nature are so complex that there must be a designer, a creator of nature. Okay, that is argument by analogy. It's illogical and it never works, except to teach. But it doesn't demonstrate anything. This is what our folks in the Discovery Institute see as the centerpiece of intelligence, this irreducible complexity. If you can take some moving parts, some working parts out, and it doesn't function anymore, then it can't have evolved. It must have been designed by some kind of creative intelligence. Now, to me, any 8-year-old with a broken bicycle chain understands this. But that doesn't mean that everything around us is designed in this way. That's not a logical conclusion as a result of this. And Mike Behe is very strong in this. The poster child is of, as you know, I may know, is the bacterial flagellum, one of these little things that's got, okay, going in, it does that, okay. And according to Behe's mythology, has 50 working parts. If you took away any of them, the thing wouldn't work anymore. However, there are other bacterial flagella that have fewer parts and they still work. And there are other parts that have fewer still and they still work, but not as a locomotory organ. They are part of the immune system. And that's actually also what the other flagella do. So the problem that Behe and his colleagues have is that they can't see how you can even get from a flagellum that is simple and is part of the T2 secretory system, immune system here, and then it gets a little bigger and it acquires a secondary function of moving a little critter around. He doesn't admit that that's possible. We call this concept exaptation. A structure has a function, and then it acquires a second function, then selection can even act on that. That's central to our biological thinking. If the creationists accept this, everything they have comes tumbling down. That's why we should teach it, teach it, teach it, and teach it. They don't accept this. Okay, I just said that. But they will accept microevolution, like just changes within kinds. All right, but they don't like anything that relates to large, you know, for some larger groups of organisms evolving some other, or complex adaptations evolving from simpler ones. What this tells me is that in our educational system, we're probably spending way too much time on fruit flies and not enough time on dinosaurs. Now, I work on dinosaurs, so I could be excused, because they're just cooler than fruit flies. Fruit flies have a lot to show us, but it's a bigger jump for kids, for students to understand that the changes we see in fruit fly genes can be extrapolated up to explain how birds evolved and how organisms came out of water and how we get flowering plants and all stuff. Like, come on, come on. You know, would you believe that? I know, that goes back to the Elliott's thing. So the complex packages, these big adaptations, can't evolve naturally. And since I work on that problem, it pisses me off. Here is the creationist view of the adaptational package of the giraffe. It's got a long neck. It's got this incredible network of blood vessels in the back of its head so that when it bends down, it doesn't blow its brains out. And, you know, it's just got these really cool things. And they got all this stuff. And this is part of the page of Pandas and People, which is the textbook that the Discovery Institute tried to get put into the Dover, Pennsylvania public schools. I want to say more about that textbook. This is it. Developed, the intelligent design proponents wanted to substitute it for traditional texts. On the cover is this panda. This is a very sad-looking panda. He knows what's inside the book. Here's a drawing from Pandas and People. They're discussing how the vertebrates came to walk on land. Notice that they show two pictures. One with it stuck out to the side, the other was stuck down. Notice that they're really different, aren't they? Can you see similarities there? Yes. Can you see differences? Are you more likely to see similarities or differences? Maybe so. Okay. It's way better to draw this. This is an evogram. The concept was developed by my grad student, Brian Swartz. And it's really nice, because at the top row, Brian put actual pictures of the evidence, or drawings of as close as we can, because sometimes fossils look like a roadkill. And below that, he put the pieces of these structures with the corresponding parts in different colors. And below that, there is a phylogeny based on all kinds of characters, not just the limb, but all sorts of things in the skeleton to tell us about what we understand, and then pictures beneath that of how we think these things might have looked in life. This is not a diagram that you can absorb in 5 seconds. It's a diagram that you could take half an hour or more and talk about all the cool things about this. But it gives us at least an idea of the evidence. I want to say in fairness that the diagram on the top is exactly how this stuff is presented in 95% of the college textbooks in biology, evolution, comparative anatomy, morphology, and paleontology. There is no difference between that treatment and pandas and people. So don't get smug. We have a lot of work to do. I just want to take one example from pandas because it's so much fun. You could read this text. Not a panda, he's just a panda. I feel bad for the panda. So you're reading this text now. By and large, Darwinists believe, oh my God, by and large, Darwinists believe, Darwinists. It's like saying a stalker. Darwinist beliefs. So these are just beliefs that we have, okay? The bones, they're just beliefs, okay? Believe that whales evolved from a land mammal. Okay, but they say, oh, but there's no evidence. We would expect some evidence. We would expect some evidence. Yeah. Okay. Here. Now, this is a sequence. When I testify the Dover trial, a bunch of our graduate students, I mean, I couldn't do all these things. I just had too much. And so I split up the examples that I gave all day to the judge. Among our graduate students, Nick Pyonson is at the Smithsonian now, did this one in Wales because he works on them, and it's really kind of cool. He started out with these, like what these early Eocene artiodactyls look like. So here's what we're talking about when whales evolve, and here's some of the critters that are living there and that we have, and that have characteristics that are like the first whales, as we'll see. And the living relatives of whales that are closest are hippos. Yay! Really cool. We didn't know that until we did their molecules, because like hippos, whales, come on, you're joking. And here's a case where the molecules helped the paleontologists, because we had no fossils of hippos before about 15, 20 million years ago. But our first whales are over 50 million years ago. So what happened to that 30, 35 million years? It's tough to hide a hippo. And they live in water where stuff gets preserved pretty good as fossils. Like, you know, come on, that's like trying to hide like an elephant. But the interesting thing was that we found out that hippos had not evolved by that time, but there were groups before hippos, like anthracotheres, that we think are closely related to them, and hippos emerged out of that group. The anthracotheres go back as early as the whales, so now we're happy. But it's a case where the molecules taught us this, which is okay, I was wrong. You know, we're wrong. It's fine, good science. This is one of the first whales we have. This is the top and the side, the bottom of its skull. This skull does not look much like a whale skull at all. But it doesn't have to look overall like a whale skull. What was interesting about it was its ear region, which had bones in a configuration that are only found in whales. That was pretty cool. The rest of its skeleton looks like this. Does that look like a whale? Say no! Jeepers! Call it flipper or something. Okay, so it doesn't. It looks like a typical walking thing with a big head and too many teeth, right? What is interesting about it is that from its bones, isotopes showed that if you examine them, just to make a long story short, we have some isotopes that give us indications of living in freshwater and some more in salt water. And that this guy, Pachycetus, fell more into the marine than the freshwater. So it gives us the idea that this guy, these whales are not just quadrupedal, terrestrial critters, but they're at least spending some time in the water, and not just the water, but in salt water. So at least brackish water, they're foraging around doing something in there. Do they look like they're great swimmers? They look like they could swim about as well as a horse, which can swim pretty good. You know, but you know, there's something else going on. So the next thing down the line is Ambulocetus, which means walking whale. And some of the cool things about this guy is they've got pretty big arms, pretty big hands, pretty big feet. The skulls are really big. We move up to Protocetus, and other cool things happen. One thing that's happened is that the hips decouple from the backbone. You might think that's very painful. But what it might correlate with, I think, what it might correlate with is the fact that they're doing more up and down movement with their back. That does not involve what happens with the hookup here at the pelvis. So when animals run along like this, when you watch a leopard, a cheetah, a dog run really fast, They really get their back in. So the back goes up and down. They're flexing their column up and down this way. Now fishes, they're like this, right? Amphibians, when they walk on land, they're like this. Snakes, they're like that. Snakes do not do this. Okay. So what happens in this case is that you have animals that are moving like this in the water because their backbones have been trained to move up and down by millions of years of evolution as mammals who are terrestrial. And that gives us that idea there. Not only that, but the nostrils are moving back along the skull, as you can see here. And think about the blowholes of whales that are back here. So this is a start on that. And one other really interesting thing is the ankles of these guys. The ankles at the top here are ankles of typical artiodactyls, or the hoof mammals I just started to show you from the beginning. They have this kind of double pulley joint at their end, and they have this little hooky thing that comes up. That's sort of their heel. And this is where the tendon's attached to move the foot. And this pulley thing is what it rotates on. Okay, that's very characteristic of artiodactyls. No other animals have this, but whales do. Even this whale, which is the Basilosaurids, so named because when they were first found, they were thought to be reptiles. But that was in the early 1800s. We now know that they weren't. And interestingly enough, the nostrils are farther back even than they were before. That there's a little tiny thing there that turns out to be a hind limb. It's very small. But you'll notice that the ankle still has that double pulley with the hook coming off it. Even though this animal not only is not walking on land, that whole apparatus is inside the skeleton. So these are remnants of its ancestry. They tell us more about use, disuse of parts, exaptation, the change like this. My feeling is if we use this, we put this and other examples in K-12 textbooks, it would be one generation before that middle portion of the U.S., the people who are not like you in this room, most of you, and who are not the fundamentalists on this side, who already know what you think, but the 40 to 50% in the middle of this country, who are open-minded enough to listen to reasonable arguments, but they have to hear what's reasonable and they have to understand good arguments and evidence for them. I think in one generation, we've got them over on this side. I think that's what it would take. Because I don't think fruit flies are doing the job. They're showing us important things, but it's not enough. And when you're younger, you want to see the big things. So let's go back to ID for a second. What's our problem with this? Well, I just showed you a bunch of stuff. Now, you know, that might be right, it might be wrong. It's going to be modified, of course, over the years. But if you tell a kid that you can't get from point A to point, you can't get from a land animal to a whale, okay? And then evidence comes up that says, well, actually, you can. What is that kid going to think? Just, you know, if you were that kid, what would you think? What would you think about your teacher? What would you think about your textbook? What would you think about your parent? You know, I don't know. So what would you think? I don't think that's a good thing to show kids. Supernatural intervention is not permissible in science. I don't like it when someone says we can't look at natural phenomena because that's all that science looks at. We don't really care about a lot of other stuff. We don't care whether Britney Spears is great or not. You know, the Kardashians don't even go there. But natural phenomena, yeah, we like to look at that. And this is the big one because we need peer review in science. It's how science works as a community. If you think you have a good idea, you have to get the evidence together, submit it, and have it judged by your peers. If there were a really good idea out there that we have been overlooking, somebody proposes it, they make their golden fortune with this. That's what we hope all our students will do. And I think this is really important to show the difference. Like a lot of people call themselves scientists. The people at the Discovery Institute are not scientists. One of them has a degree. It's from Berkeley. I don't think that anyone has cited or used any of the work that came out of his degree. It's just not that interesting, and it certainly doesn't bear on evolution. But some people think, well, if I have a PhD, then I'm a scientist and I get respect. Well, actually, you don't. What I think about string theory, there isn't a physicist in the world who cares about that, and rightly so. A pharmacist has a degree, but I don't really care what a pharmacist thinks about plate tectonics. You got to study that stuff. And that's the whole peer review thing. The ID folks and people with religious backgrounds don't like it when a scientist talks about theology. But I figure they talk about science all the time, so. And I'm just saying stuff that these are questions that my own students bring up when we talk about this. This is a problem for a lot of people with religious faith. If ID is right, then the Creator did not make a perfectly designed world. He's got to tinker with it later. That's a theological problem for some people. Divine intervention is a big problem. I mean, almost post-Renaissance theology does not use a whole lot of divine intervention. Their pseudo-scientific approach, I don't want to test religious ideas. I mean, give me a class of third graders to talk about Noah's Ark, and after 30 minutes, I'll give you back a classroom full of little atheists. I don't want to go there. I really don't want to go there. I don't think science should go there. I think people should figure out for themselves what those cultural artifacts and documents mean to them. That's not my business. This is the question of theodicy. It's really tough. The Discovery Institute people say they're working on it. You can go back to the Zoroastrians, and they were working on it. And this is a really big one for a lot of kids. And as you know, there have been empirical tests of prayer and non-prayer and prayer and control groups. And this is just too painful for people in our society to deal with. Okay, so, you know, what I say is on these issues, don't push us. Because if we push back, no one is going to be happy. The Discovery Institute doesn't want people to know what they're really up against or up about. So they have a document called the Wedge Document, how they were going to drive a wedge between secularism and American society. Of course, it got leaked. And Barbara Forrest and Gross wrote an amazing book about it. Barbara Forrest was the one person in the Dover trial that they tried to exclude from testifying because they knew that if we didn't do anything else but have Barbara get up there and talk, she would blow them a new protostome. And she did, because she knew what they were doing, and she knew philosophically and sociologically what this was all about. Now, I want to tell you that this statement here from the mission statement of the Discovery Institute is not just about evolution. It's about all American institutions. It's about all American institutions. They want them to become theocratic. There is no difference between what they think and what is going on in Iran or Saudi Arabia, a theocratic country. That's what these people want. I don't even know if they're Americans, honestly. And what are we going to figure out with this? You know, whose Christian and theistic convictions are we talking about? Among them, they say, look, let's get rid of the secularists, then we'll decide these other questions. Oh, yeah, good. Swell. So that brings us to the trial, which was based on the fact that the Dover School Board that had a couple of religious fundamentalists on it who were real bullies and crazy besides, frankly. They just said the weirdest things. And they wanted to make the teachers substitute their Miller and Levine textbook, which they said was laced with Darwinism. They wanted to replace it with pandas. And the teacher said, no, we're not going to do that. Pandas is a stupid book. Do you know how hard it is for teachers to say that to district officials? Do you know how little protection you're going to get from administrators in 99 out of 100 districts? I mean, these are the real heroes. It's the teachers. And they said, we're not going to put this book, and we're not going to teach this book. And the administrator said, okay, well, look, we'll just put them in the classrooms, and then when you get to the evolution unit, you can refer students. We're not going to do that, because it's a stupid book. Okay, well then, We'll put all the copies in the library, and you can tell the students they can go and look at it if they want to as an alternative to what you're teaching. No, we're not doing that. Okay, well then, we've got this little statement here that says students will be made aware of the gaps and problems and that there are other alternatives that they should, like intelligent design, for example. And the teacher said, we're not reading that. So the administrator said, well, okay. Then when you get to the evolution unit, we'll send in an administrator, and the administrator will read the statement to the students, and then this administrator will leave, and there will be no questions and no discussion. Pedagogical principles, anyone? Yeah. So the teacher said, nah. The district administrator came in and did that. A group of parents sued, and we were on our way. Now, the people who... they are really wonderful people. Steve Harvey on the left, Eric Rothschild on the right, both from Pepper Hamilton in Philadelphia. In the middle, Vic Welchek, head of the ACLU in Pittsburgh, Colgate graduate, yes, philosophy major, yes. Liberal arts education. Yes. Okay. Springsteen freak. Yes! During the whole trial, Springsteen is roaring everywhere. Part Man, Part Monkey becomes the official song of the trial. Springsteen weighs in on the trial in an interview with Esquire. He says, you know, out there in Dover, Pennsylvania, you know, they're still worried, they're still arguing about evolution. You know, here in New Jersey, we're counting on it. And after the trial, a couple of Springsteen concerts, Vic, who's nuts, got Springsteen to like play requests, and Springsteen would dedicate them to the teachers and parents in Dover, which was really wonderful. So these guys were great, and our nonprofit, the National Center for Science Education, put together basically the whole plaintiff's case because we had been following this even before it erupted, because the teachers had let us know. And we have people who handle what we call flare-ups, and we take care of these things and kind of talk to people, come on, let's calm down, let's see what we're talking about here, let's not get people to, let's not blow this up. But the school board was not capable of being placated. So it turned into a real problem. Now, I should say that the Discovery Institute instigated this because they would send around little videos to school districts saying, you can teach intelligent design as science in your classrooms. And then if a school district were interested, they would send somebody to come and talk with them about that because they wanted a test case. Well, they got it. They just didn't know how crazy the Dover School Board was because they couldn't control them, essentially. I mean, we didn't realize it. We didn't realize all of these things that were going on. But the DI just could not get the school board members to stop talking about Jesus and to kind of follow their party line here and be very, you know, straight arrow and not put religion to it. So that was a big problem for them. And the trial was kind of interesting because one of the more memorable moments was when Eric Rothschild, who you just saw in the last photo, was questioning, was cross-examining Mike Behe, who does not accept that the immune system of humans could have evolved. We don't have any explanation for that. And so Eric took this whole pile of books and articles and things like that and put it on top of the witness instead of in front of Behe, who has to kind of peer around it, and says, so this isn't good enough. And this is the judge's opinion. This is how the judge saw this event. It's not good enough. But actually, this is not fair to Mike Behe. Because what Mike said in response to Eric's question, so this isn't good enough. Mike said that it doesn't demonstrate that this came about by random mutation and natural selection. Because no one was there to see it after all. That's the premise that they use. And that's the definition of evolution they use. So this is where all this comes from, okay? The kicker in the trial, at NC, the other thing we have at NCSE is a great archive of stuff. And During the course of the trial, our archivist, Jessica Moran, found an old note from Tom Jukes, who was a great biochemist, biophysicist, molecular biologist at Berkeley. Terrific man. And he had written a little note on a copy of the Bible Science newsletter, which Tom got because they wanted to keep up with these people. And there was a little ad in the Bible Science newsletter that said, writers wanted to help with a book on creation biology. And Tom thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So he sent along and said, you know, somebody should just be watching out for this. Well, yeah, we kept that in the files, and people did. And during the course of the trial, Jessica said, you know, this might be interesting. And we go, whoa, yeah, right. Because pandas did not come from nowhere. It was the most recent iteration of a book that started out as Creation Biology in 1983. And its next title was Biology and Creation. And then Biology and Origins. And then what happened? Then pandas, the first version. These are all drafts. Okay. And they're published by the Foundation for Thought and Ethics down outside Fort Worth. And what happened where those red and blue lines cross was the court decision that said creation science could not be taught as science. And then, well, nobody here but us scientists. So they changed. Every mention of creationist became intelligent design instead. Now, if you want a better indication of the smoking gun for why creationism mutated into intelligent design, see, creationism evolves. Right? If you want a better indication of where that happens, we have a missing link. You know, are you getting this? You know, sometimes it's like, you know, you highlight something and you want to replace with another word and your word and it doesn't, and then there's something like really embarrassing. Yeah. Wouldn't you like a t-shirt with that? Yeah, because C design proponentists is about as good as you're going to get. So the judge decided three major things. The first was easy, that the Dover School Board, like the separation of church and state, the Establishment Clause was violated. That's, they're saying Jesus all over the place. I mean, you know, that was really simple. And our lawyers at first argued that that's all we should be going for. But we knew that if we did that, we would be simply arguing this case again another 6 months. So we said, no, there's two more things. We're going for blood. And we need a judgment that intelligent design is not accepted as science by the scientific community. And why? And the other thing we need is to get this bogus crap criticisms of evolution that have all been, you know, answered a million times in the scientific literature. We need to get those out of the way. And we got those three things, which was really cool. And some people were not happy with the verdict because the judge had been appointed by George Bush. He was a friend of Tom Ridge. It was known that he had political aspirations, and they thought that he was in their pocket. And we didn't know how he was going to rule. But the judge also had a very good liberal arts education from Dickinson College, and he thought that he was not convinced by anything the ID people said. His decision was over 140 pages. It was extremely long. There was not a word in it that the other side would have liked, because they would have driven a truck through it. And he did this deliberately because he didn't want people to do this again in 6 months somewhere else, which was really, really great of him. And I came back for the decision because he was supposed to announce his decision on December 20th, 21st. And so I went back to Harrisburg, and all the lawyers were there and all the people we worked with. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, we're looking to see, because it's going to be on, you know, it's going to be dumped in the box, emails, attachments. And then, so it comes in. Oh, judgment's here. Okay, boom, open it up. People start printing it out. I start reading through it. And I'm starting to read through it, and I suddenly hear all these whoops and screams and hollers coming from all different parts of the building. And then the sports metaphors come out. You know, bottom of the ninth inning, you know, grand slam, like a walk-off on this. Because the lawyers were smart. They went to the back. I'm reading from the front. Like, they went to the back, and they got the judgment. It's like, oh, boy. Right here. Ask hand. Okay, good. Nice. The judge got death threats. He had to have federal marshals protect him and his family. He did not get death threats from evolutionists. So the very quick thing about it is, what is next? What the judge did in the trial was to blow ID out of the water. It no longer, instantly, no one ever talked about it as science again. It was gone. And you haven't heard a lot about it in other areas either, because it's just dead. I mean, out in the hinterlands, in individual districts where nobody's paying attention, individual teachers, parents, people like that can fly under the radar and all kinds of stuff happens. But that was it. They are looking for a better test case. And these words on the bottom, teaching the controversy. What controversy? See? Critical thinking means that you criticize things you don't agree with. Academic freedom means I can bring in anything I want and talk about it. And that's exactly the law that just passed in Tennessee. So now we have the prospect of another test case, if it goes much farther and gets tested. Because it says that despite a state curriculum, despite what's in textbooks, despite what everyone agrees on, a teacher can bring in any kind of thing and introduce any kind of stuff they want towards anything they consider controversial. Which means that if climate change is mentioned, you're going to see more Glenn Beck videos. Because that's where the controversy comes in. So, teaching evolution is a good idea. And if you will please support us, we would be happy. We're happy to do the work. We don't want you to duplicate it, but we will appreciate your support. Thanks so much.